Hi, I'm Dr. Caroline Leaf and welcome to my podcast, Cleaning Up the Mental Mess. Who you are in this moment, whether you're on a plane, sitting at your kitchen table, or on your bed, is who you really are. If you don't like who that is, it is up to you to do something about it. In today's podcast, I talk with Dr. Sarah Kubrick about understanding the philosophical questions that have been asked over the ages. Who am I really? We dive into what the self really is using practical analogies and metaphors. But more importantly, we talk about how you can change yourself in this moment through taking responsibility and recognizing that our degree of freedom to grow ourselves will always match our degree of responsibility. Let's dive in. Sarah, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. Welcome to the podcast, and I can't wait to interview you about your wonderful new book.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to get to chat.
Oh, so am I. This is such an important topic. You know, as you say, you're an existential therapist, psychotherapist, so you're really into these big questions that we all love to ask. And since the beginning of time, we've been asking, you know, who am I? And you really tackle that. That's really something that you find extremely important. Can you just tell my viewers and my listeners a little bit about who you are? What does it mean to be an existential psychotherapist? And, you know, the deep questions, how you tackle the deep questions of life in a very, very practical way.
Yeah. So I'm Sarah Kubrick, often known as the Millennial Therapist, which is kind of a name I inherited due to my Instagram handle, ironically enough. I have a doctorate in psychotherapy sciences, and I'm a clinician. So I think that's a sufficient overview. But what is an existential psychotherapist? I know it sounds like it makes sense, but does it? And I think it's when we think about psychotherapy, there are different types of modality through which you can practice. And depending on how you practice, it's how you perceive human suffering. So if you're a cognitive behavioral therapist, you will look at the cognition and the behavior. I'm really reducing this. I understand there's a lot of complexity there. And I feel like when you're an existential psychotherapist, what you're doing is you're tugging on the themes of existential philosophy. So you're tugging on themes of isolation and meaning and responsibility and death and freedom. And so when I'm looking at a client sitting across from me, I'm trying to understand what they're going through, what their suffering is like, and what their end goals are with this existential framework of what I think is meaningful in kind of helping them get there. And what was your third question?
That third question was... You deal with the deep questions of life. The third question was the big question, the who am I? Why am I here? Those things. You really tackle that. You're a big on tackling who am I, where am I, why am I here, taking responsibility for your life. And so I love your approach.
Thank you. Yeah, I think we all go through life without understanding who we are. And that's a little bit like watching a movie without understanding who the main character is. It's really difficult. You don't know what the perspective is. You don't understand what's unfolding. Is there character development? Are they doing what they're supposed to be doing? You don't really understand the context of what you're seeing in general. And I think so many of us do that. We walk through life without realizing who is engaging with the life that we're observing. And then also as a therapist, if you're a therapist, it's like you have someone sitting in front of you and there's so much more than a problem or an issue. They're a human being. They have a sense of self. And so how are you connecting with their sense of self rather than just, you know, getting your hands dirty and going in for the kill, kind of going in for problem solving and helping them reduce their symptoms? It's like, who are you actually seeing? Who's actually in your therapeutic setting? And I think that's what I find so, so interesting.
And you found with your experience over the years that, as you say in your book, by the way, we're talking about Tara's new book, It's On Me, such an amazing book that's coming out very soon, is you talk a lot about the approach that you use is to try and help people start there with finding themselves, which means there's a lot of responsibility. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's really very, very vital.
So the sense of self, I don't believe is something that is found. I think there's a lot of content out there that's like go find who you really are, and that to me sounds like you're going into a closet finding a piece of clothing and you're like, ah, here it is, and I'm gonna put it on and I'm just gonna wear that for the rest of my life. Yeah, and that's just not how it works. I think we create our sense of self. Our sense of self is constantly changing and shifting and adapting. Anything that happens to you changes you. So this conversation that we're having right now, I'm conscious that it will change the way I think about something. It will impact me. So me prior to this conversation is kind of a slightly different version than me after this conversation. And I think that the responsibility piece really comes in terms of like, what sorts of things are you exposing yourself to if everything impacts you? And what decisions are you making to create your sense of self? The only way we create ourselves is through our action. And so I think when I think about responsibility, there is no self without responsibility. There's no authentic self without responsibility. There's a lot of self-loss without responsibility.
Talk about that. That's quite a big statement you've just made. A lot of self-loss without responsibility. That's huge.
Yeah. I think that if you don't take responsibility for yourself, you're just going to be shaped and molded by the things that have happened to you, or you're going to be shaped and molded by passivity, by not, you know, by just allowing life to go and going with the flow. And all of these things will end up shaping you. And I think that when you wake up one day, and I don't know if any of the listeners have felt this, but I had a moment where I woke up one day and I went, wow, the life I'm living is not mine. There is nothing mine in this life. I don't recognize myself in it. The things I'm doing, I don't feel possession or ownership or authenticity with. And it was just a really disorienting and horrifying feeling. And I think a lot of us have these moments to an extent of like waking up being like, wait, what is all of this? Like what for and why? And do I even want it? And I know in relationships, people will wake up one day and be like, why am I dating this person? Why am I married to this person? And like, it's those moments that often we stumble upon because we went on autopilot and because we didn't make intentional choices and because we didn't take responsibility. And I'm not suggesting you married the wrong person, but what I mean, that feeling is maybe you let 3-4 months go by without intentionally engaging with your partner. And then you wake up and you go, it's like when you drive home and you're like, how did I get here? You know, like you kind of know you were driving, but like you kind of spaced out. That's the feeling that I think creeps in and can lead to self-loss when we don't take responsibility. I had this example in my book of Chad, I think is what I call him. And, you know, he went through something really horrible as a teenager. His parents either got a divorce or, you know, his first girlfriend broke his heart and cheated on him. And that's, you know, really imprinted on him. And we need to validate that was a difficult thing he went through. Yeah. But now Chad is 35 years old and he's treating every partner like garbage. You know, he's mistreating every single human he's in contact with. And I think my question in the book is like, at what point does Chad need to take responsibility for the way he's acting? At what point do these formative experiences no longer justify what's happening? And I think, you know, they explain what's happening, but they don't justify what's happening. I think, you know, then people go, well, yeah, he needs to change so he's not hurting the people around him. And I go, no, Chad needs to change so he's not hurting himself. This is self-work. Like, yes, I feel bad for Amanda who stumbled upon Chad. But really why I want Chad to heal is for Chad. Chad is having a really hard time. And so this is where the self-loss comes in. But that's an example.
Summer, or actually any holiday season, is such a delightful time, isn't it? A chance to take a break from the daily grind and enjoy life to the fullest. However, all the fun aside, we often find ourselves taking a break from our health routine too. Late nights, irregular eating habits, and indulgence become the norm. But when the vacation season winds down, it's time to get back on track with our health. Although it may not be easy, it's essential for our well-being. If you struggle to return to your health routine, I have a valuable lesson to share. Focus on majors. Prioritize healthy thinking, eating, exercise, and quality sleep. Sleep is the key to your body's rejuvenation and repair process. It helps control our hormones, boost energy levels, and impacts countless other vital functions. Good night's sleep will improve your well-being much more than anything else. That's why I recommend you start taking magnesium daily, but not just any supplement. Get Magnesium Breakthrough by Bio-Optimizers. Magnesium Breakthrough contains all 7 forms of magnesium designed to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up refreshed. The sleep benefits are truly remarkable. And once your sleep is optimized, you'll find it much easier to tackle all the other major aspects of your health. Trust me, it's a game changer. Visit magbreakthrough.com/Dr. Leaf and enter the code DrLeaf10 for 10% off any order. This special offer is only available at magbreakthrough.com/Dr. Leaf. The link and details will be in the show notes. I love that. That's incredible. That until we take responsibility, we're going to keep hurting ourselves. It's almost like we have to learn to live with ourselves. And what you said there, which is very powerful, is yes, the past does impact. And you have a very interesting past, which I want to get into in a moment. But we have to, at some point in our life, recognize and honor the impact of the past. But we have to take that responsibility to start moving forward. And the reason I'm so pleased to discuss this is because, as you know, a lot of the work I do is neuroplasticity based from the years 1980. 1990, I did some of the first work in the field of neuroplasticity, and my whole focus is on we keep changing, and change is good, and it's a growth process, and you've got to keep moving forward. You've got to learn to live with yourself. So we're in the same wheelhouse. But I love how you
totally.
I love how you're focusing on the fact that we've. I'm going to stress that again, that yes, the past does impact us because it wires in, it's part of our network, it drives us. But at some point, we have to realize that that impact may be actually hurting us. The way we're coping with the impact is hurting ourselves, keeping us stuck, and then also impacting others. And until we take responsibility and work on ourselves, and Sarah, this is something you and I've just chatted about in the past before, but there's a lot of focus currently in our Insta therapy world that we live in with Instagram and which is really great. There's good and bad in everything, but there's a lot of issue, a lot around saying, well, it's my mother's fault or it's this one's fault, or, you know, it's almost like bubble wrap so that I don't get triggered. And, you know, there's almost like it's great. We've got this tremendous awareness of the impact of our past and that early childhood experiences will influence the future and that whatever happens. So this, we have an awareness of that now. And I'm so grateful that we're at that point in life that we are talking about that. But at the same time, we seem to have got stuck. My next question is, it feels like we've kind of got stuck in the impact, but we haven't stepped over sufficiently into what am I going to do about this? Because we can't now wrap ourselves in bubble wrap and think, well, I'm going to put up these boundaries. Boundaries are, as you and I both know, overused and incorrectly used in so many places to keep people out, to don't trigger me, don't upset me, don't read that at college because that's going to hurt this one. We have to realize that life is hard and that you bubble wrapping yourself is not the way to do it. And I see that in your work as this whole concept of taking responsibility for the impact of your life. Why don't you talk a little bit about that and then maybe transition over into your history, which is absolutely fascinating. You went through a huge amount as a young child.
Yeah. So I remember writing the book and everyone was like, what is the promise? I don't know. You've written many books, but it's like, what is the promise you're giving the reader? Right? Like that's exactly. Like a phrase in it that I've encountered. And it was so interesting because any promise I was giving, they were like, well, that doesn't sound like a promise, you know, because I think the promises saying, yeah. we see on Instagram is like, and then I will make your life better. And then yeah. You're going to love yourself. And then you're going to just like have the perfect relationship. Oh my God, you're just going to. And it's like, I am not going to promise any of those things because it's
so
not
good.
I personally cannot promise you that. Maybe someone else can, and maybe they can deliver and I'm in awe. I cannot because yeah. of what you just said. Life is so complex. Life is so messy. Life is so freaking hard.
Yeah.
No amount of self-help is going to change those facts.
No, no.
But what I'm going to help you do is learn how to sit with the mess.
Yeah.
How to play in the mess, how to find beauty in the mess, and how to still construct an authentic sense of self, construct your sense of meaning within the chaos. Mm-hmm. That is all I can help you with. I cannot promise you a perfect life or a happy life, but I can try to help you live an authentic and meaningful life. And so I think that's what my work really focuses on, because it's really, I think the over-promising has to stop because people are going to be so disappointed.
Well,
life's real hard.
No, that was excellent. And people are jumping from one thing to the next, looking for the next 5 steps, the next 7 steps, the next optimization principle, the next this, the next. And it's always that end focus. And it's just imbalanced and it's tipped over to the wrong side. And we need to bring back to reality. And as you say, we've got to sit with the mess. That's why this podcast is called Cleaning Up Your Mental Mess, which the main part is, it's okay to be a mess. But now what are you going to do about it? Because we're all messy. There isn't a human who isn't messy.
Of course. And I love, what are you going to do about it? That is just like such a core question in my practice of like, all of this has happened. It sucks. It's unfair. We can label it whatever you want to label it and validate it. And unfortunately for you, now what are you going to do about it? Because you're the only one that can do something about it. And I know sometimes that feels unfair. Some people are like, well, they broke me. They hurt me. Why am I the one cleaning up the mess? Because it's your life and no one else can do it for you. And I understand that that's fundamentally unfair, but it is your responsibility. And so what are you going to do about it is one of my favorite questions, because at the end of the day, what are you going to do about it?
I love it. That's why I think we click, because it's one of the main questions that I asked for 25 years practicing, and it's in every single one of my books. This has happened. Now, what are we going to do about it? And that's the core issue. And it's not invalidating a person's pain, but I see so much in, and I'm sure you see this too, so much of people getting so stuck in their pain, saying that I can't help it, I can't choose, I have no control. And I think a lot of it's to do with the messaging that is currently out there of, you know, your pain broke you and you're broken and you're stuck, and the biomedical model doesn't help, because then it's, as you mentioned earlier, you said the word symptom relief. We can't just do symptom relief. That's not going to, that works for an autoimmune disorder or cardiovascular issues or something, but it doesn't work for when it comes to the issues of life and the issues of mind. We're not just going to get rid of a symptom. That's just a band-aid approach. We have to get to the depth, and the depth is getting to, can you live with yourself? So I so often would say to my patients, and I know you've said this, you've got to learn to live with yourself. And live and sit with yourself and live with yourself. And when you do that, that's when you can start moving forward.
No, and I love it. What are you going to do about it is an empowering question. If you could do nothing about it, then I wouldn't ask you that question.
Exactly.
I think there's something very empowering of like, what are you going to do? You have the autonomy. You are empowered enough to do something about this. And I think instead of seeing that question as blamey or as unfair, and trust me, I've had people ask me that question when I didn't like hearing it.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
The point is that it's such an empowering thing, because in my book, I talk about how we always have a sense of freedom and a sense of responsibility. And I tread it so carefully, but I have many of examples. If you're triggered by me saying that statement, pick up the book and read what I mean, because it's unpacked very detailedly, like why I say what I say. But it's like, that statement should tell you that you're alive. That statement should tell you that you own your life and can do something with it. And so I want to have like that positive spin on a question of like, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, it's your life. You can change it. So you can't change what's happened to you, but you can change how it looks, what it looks like inside of you, and how it plays out into your future, which is another thing that I say all the time. It's the hard stuff is the good stuff. That's where we start moving.
Stuff.
Yeah, that's one of the things I say a lot as well. The hard stuff is the good stuff. So, okay, so the hard stuff is the good stuff. Now, you had a very, very hard upbringing, and you've really turned it into some good stuff, and you're still battling. You're still going through, and you're so honest and authentic about it. Would you mind sharing a little bit about your background and your history?
Yeah, of course. So I was born in Bosnia right before the Bosnian War started. And then my family fled to Serbia. And then we were in Serbia during the NATO bombings. And then we immigrated to Canada when I was 9. And so I think that's a lot more suffering than I would have liked to have experienced by the age of 9, but I'm robbing my childhood. I think there's something really blissful about the ignorance of being a child and believing in the goodness of the world and the safety of the world. And I feel like that was ripped away from me immediately. I think something that I didn't realize was that these experiences were traumatic. So this is kind of the irony of it, of like everyone around me, especially my family, experienced the same thing. And when I was growing up, for me, it was like, oh, this is just life. Nothing about it signaled like this is abnormal or this is traumatic. To me, it was like, oh, this is life.
This is
and in my book, I talk about how I was in survival mode until my mid-20s. I didn't even realize I was in survival mode, but of course I was. And I think my life drastically changed when I stepped from survival mode to self-awareness mode. But I think it was an interesting shift. And I didn't realize that the things that I was doing were even, that I've lived through even impacted me. Like that's how unaware I was, because where I come from, it impacted everyone. So it's almost like negated everything. It's like everyone's impacted by this, but so then no one's impacted by this. And so that's kind of my background of like, why do humans do the things that they do? Why do we harm people? What is the point of life? Who am I? Especially as an immigrant, that's a question. Or someone who has a dad who is Bosnian, a mom who is Serbian within the Balkan context. It's a lot of identity questions. And so, you know, I read Dostoevsky when I was 9 because I felt like Crime and Punishment and Notes from the Underground really resonated with my lived experiences at age 13, rather than reading, you know, the books that my peers were reading in Canada. And so that's just a little bit about my background, and it definitely informs the work that I do, and why I went into this type of work.
And how did it show up in your 20s? That you said it made a very big change in your life. And first of all, I'm sorry that you had to go through that. And it's thank you for sharing that perspective.
Yeah. So how did it show up in my 20s? I think because I was in survival mode, I slipped into self-loss without realizing it. Survival mode is like, I will tread water, but nothing was authentic, aligned, intentional. It was just battling perceived threats all the time. And I think I made a lot of decisions that just were not aligned with my sense of self. And I didn't even know who I was. I was so far, like, and I ended up getting married when I shouldn't have gotten married. And I ended up just living a life that I very, very, very much did not love. And I started to hate myself because I think deep down I understood I was the reason I was living this life. Because who else was I to blame? I think, you know, I went through all these, like, who can I blame? And then I was like, well, no one forced me to walk down the aisle. No one forced me to be an overachiever at school. No one forced me to do all these things. And so I think deep down, I started to hate myself without realizing that I was hating myself. And so I had a panic attack on a flight, which was, which is how I actually opened my book. And I think that one moment when my body, when I felt embodied, probably for the first time in a really long time, when my body spoke up and went, that's enough, you're done. This, you have suffered enough, and I am going to intervene and try to bring to your awareness what you have been suppressing for 20 years. I think that's when my self-awareness finally started to evolve and develop, and when I realized how lost I was. And that was a really, really terrifying feeling for me.
Wow, that was, I remember reading that story in your book and how you were actually meeting with a friend at a pub in LA, and that person turned around and said to you, are you happy? And it just triggered, was that question just triggered, but you'd reached that point. And it so often is in the 20s that happens, because we get pretty good at suppressing. And I saw a lot of my patients, it was in their mid-20s as well, that there would be this kind of crisis. And that's often when, if it's been mismanaged, people then start, you know, giving the very scary mental health labels, and they start going down a track that can be very frightening. So I'm so pleased that you offer an alternative that really supports what I believe in, which is, let's start looking at ourselves. And yes, we recognize all the damage of being in the war, being in all these things, but that suppression, what it eventually will do to one, and how one's body and unconscious mind will help advise us, literally. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it?
Advise us. And anxiety is horrible, but self-loss was worse. You know what I mean? Like, self-loss was the real depth of it, of like, I'm one of the lucky ones that, you know, my anxiety symptoms went away once I did this inner work. And I know that that's not the case for everyone, nor is the trigger the same for everyone. And I want to honor that. But for me, who's experienced both, it was like the anxiety was scary, but looking in and seeing nothing,
that was worse.
Felt like dying. It was death. Like, it was an existential death. And that, it's not comprehensible. That's when you go, there's no reason for me to be here. And that is a really, really scary, scary moment to live.
Thank you for sharing that. And I'm sure there's people that are listening now that are in that place at the moment or have been there or know someone who is there. And how would you handle talking to someone who's in that space where you were? What would you say?
It's really important to realize that just because you don't see it, it doesn't mean it's not there. Right? Like it is there. And I think getting as much support as possible is so, so important. This type of work, I went to therapy for years and I can't fathom not having that kind of support. And I know not everyone can afford that or is privileged enough to have access to that, but have a friend, have someone, talk to them about these experiences. I think I felt so isolated in them until I started talking about them and realizing that so many people experience it. And then as a therapist, seeing it in my clients was a really cool thing. Then seeing it in my research during my master's and my doctorate, it was just like, wow, this is something that so many of us experience. And although we feel so alone in those moments, chances are we're not. And I think that was a really healing thing. It was a really, really healing thing. And then also realizing that if you don't know who you are in this moment or you don't like who you are in this moment, what are you going to do about it? It's back to that question, but it's asked with so much love and empowerment because you can change that. And I feel like I can say that confidently because I lived through it and I feel like I've changed it. And as you said, it's not all smooth sailing, but it's like I've done it and I am so happy right now in my life. And I look back 10 years ago and I go, that version of me can't even comprehend where we are right now. And that's, I think, really beautiful.
That's beautiful because in that moment 10 years ago, you didn't ever think you'd reach the point that you reach now. So it's hope for people that are in that state. And I'm sure these up and down days, well, not I'm sure, I know these up and down days, but you've got the tools in place to deal with it. You've got the tools in place when you feel that emptiness or the self-hate or whatever it may be coming up. You recognize that you've got through, that you've got that and you've got to the other side. And now it's just the journey on the other side, which is so important to recognize. And it's a huge part of that journey is the responsibility.
Responsibility, but also realizing like you're, as a human, you're meant to feel these lows. Yes. Like I think that was a big part of my
healing.
Thank you
for saying that.
Part of my healing was realizing that I'm going to have many existential crises throughout my life. And instead of letting it threaten me, I let it inform me. I go, okay, so this is like a check-in. Am I the person I want to be? Am I living with meaning? And I kind of just try to engage with it and let it wash over me because that is the point. That's what you're going to be experiencing for the next 50 years is those lows or those questions or those discomforts. And I think we need tension to grow. I genuinely believe that. And so it creates tension. And anytime I'm in tension, it's kind of reframing. And I go, wow, this I'm growing right now. And I think that that's a really cool changing the relationship to your pain is really powerful. And I think part of my healing was changing my relationship to any discomfort or pain that I now feel. Do I love it? Am I like, bring on the pain? No. But am I in a healthy relationship with my pain? At least right now, I do feel like I am.
Children learn and make sense of the world around them through play. While they're having fun, they are developing their cognitive, physical, social, and emotional skills. But play is also the key in building your child's mental health and is a great way to relieve stress. That's why I designed and developed Brainy, a super cute plush toy to help your child learn about their incredible brains and minds and how to understand and express emotions in a healthy way. Brainy will help your little ones become super self-regulators from young. And to help your child even more, I designed a coloring book for kids to help your child learn about emotions and thoughts and how to manage them. This coloring book is also a great way to spend time with your child or students as you color together while learning how to express feelings in a healthy way. And right now you can get both Brainy and the coloring book on sale for 15% off with the code BRAINY15 at drleaf.com. The link will be in the show notes. So Sarah, there's one of my favorite quotes in your book is this one. I'm going to read it. It's the hard truth. Who you are in this moment, whether you are on a plane, sitting at your kitchen table or on your bed, is who you really are. If you don't like who that is, it's up to you to do something about it. To me, that just encapsulates a huge amount of what you're trying to say. So talk to me about that.
Yeah, I think a lot of us have a perception of who we are, right? Like, it's like, well, I'm this kind of person. And I am, for example, I'm gentle and I'm kind and I'm so open-minded. And then we get put into situations where we don't act like those things. And sometimes I find that interesting because in that moment, we either engage in cognitive dissonance or we realize that perhaps who we are isn't really who we think we are, which is also okay. And I think sometimes we have to come to that realization of like, I think that I'm super kind and have endless amount of patience, but when someone cuts me off in a car, I am like rolling down my window. I am yelling.
Throwing zap signs.
Yeah. And I guess what I'm saying is in that moment, you're not patient. You're not that patient person that you think you are. Who you are in that moment is this impatient person who's having a tough day and is taking it out on someone else.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's okay. And I guess what I really want to encapsulate with that quote is like, you are how you behave. You are who you are in this moment because you don't have any other moments. You don't have your past moments with you right now. You don't have the future moments. So if you're looking in a mirror and you can't recognize this person, if you're doing an action that you can't recognize yourself or don't like, if you're sitting here and just feeling really at ease with yourself and really aligned, this is the moment that you have. This is what's telling you who you are in this very moment. And if it's not something you like, it's on you to change it.
I love that. I love that. Then you have something else in your book that it's one of my favorite things as well, is you have that whole visualization. I'm going to read the visualization to you, and then maybe you could read back the interpretation, but it just encapsulates everything you've been saying. It's a great place for us to sort of transition to. So imagine you're alone sitting in a worn leather armchair in the middle of a room. In front of you is a chipped coffee table straining to support the weight of the numerous dusty books that you intended to read but never found time for. You have a cup of coffee that has grown cold, the milk curdled on the surface. On the side table next to you is a vintage green lamp, merely ornamental ever since the room has been set ablaze. The flames are creeping up the walls, peeling the wallpaper and sending parachutes of ash into midair. The flares slowly inch towards you, little sparks burning holes in the rug at your feet. You can barely see through the haze, your lungs full with smoke, your eyes water. Yet, you continue to sit there paying bills, checking your email, making work deadlines, sending long upset text messages, or posting inspirational quotes on Instagram, ignoring your impending death. You hear faint instinctual inner screams, a voice deep inside you urging you to move. But instead, you convince yourself that this is fine. That you're fine, in control even, that the way you have chosen to live will not hurt you. Your life is threatened, but for some reason or another, you don't see it. You ignore it, or perhaps you're waiting for someone else to save you. You're too busy to save yourself, or maybe you notice the flames, but you're preoccupied with debating who set the fire in the first place. You'd rather figure out who to blame than find a way to live. Regardless of the specifics, you don't choose to extinguish the fire, which ultimately means you're choosing to get burned. So very powerful.
Yeah.
So you say you often will start with your patient sessions, the first session with this imagery, and then you have an interpretation in the book of what that means.
Yeah, I do the imagery because I think when you're listening to it, something within you goes, move, like, what are you doing? Right? Like, that's anyone who reads that, it's like, what is this person doing? And I think it just shows you the experience of what it's like to be lost and not to move. And a lot of my clients will recognize their own passivity or lack of taking responsibility within that story. And how I used to end it is the very last line, instead of you're choosing to get burned, I say you're choosing to die. And what I mean by that is like existential death. But I think that was a little heavy. So I chose burned. I think burned was good.
Good. It is.
And what we do is I get them to interpret it for me, and then I will tell them what the visualization actually means. And so this is what I say to them. We're alone in the room because that's a given. No one will ever truly know what it's like to be us. The old worn armchair represents the comfort we feel from the habits and patterns we've developed. It's placed in the center of the room because we're often, for better or for worse, the focal point of our own lives. Our strained relationships, the table, are burdened by our lack of self-growth and healing, the unopened books. The cold coffee represents time passing and complacency settling in. The lamp represents our dimming awareness, its light overpowered by the flames, our denial, creeping up the walls. The wallpaper represents our boundaries. Over time, it begins to peel off and compromise the integrity of the room, of who we are. The rug, our foundation, beliefs, morals, values, is set ablaze, and we struggle to find our footing. The blurred vision is the detrimental stories we tell ourselves, and the smoke filling our lungs is all the things we consume that we believe will make us whole, but don't. We successfully ignore signs of danger and the call of responsibility. We surrender our freedom and risk our lives to enjoy the warmth of the familiar and so-called obligations and day-to-day mundanities. We may not know why we find ourselves in a burning room or who is to blame, but ultimately the only thing that matters is what we do about it. It's beautiful. Like practicing to read before coffee. It's good.
It's so good. It's excellent because it kind of sums up everything that we've been trying to talk about. And I would encourage people to get hold of the book, which is called It's On Me. It's amazing because you really unpack that. That's why I wanted to end with that analogy and that little visualization of what it means, because I believe it sums up what we've been trying to say. So any last words that you'd like to sort of sum up this conversation that we could go on for hours, because there's so many aspects, but I think it's a great start for people to start really getting into the understanding and facing the fact, am I in that room? Is that who I am? Is that happening to me? What does that mean for my life? And, you know, what am I going to do about it? Any last words that you'd like to say around encouraging people if they feel that this is something that they relate to?
You're not alone. There is a reality in which you live a life that you respect, a life that feels like your own. I'm not going to say a life that's happy and dandy. And I think it's important to notice if your relationship are constantly failing, if you have a pattern you can't get out of, if you're struggling to make decisions, if you don't recognize yourself in your decisions, a lot of these things can be traced back to self-loss. I know so many of us are exhausted and we look at all these terms being thrown around or, you know, psychological diagnoses and we're like, well, we don't fit with this, but something still feels off. And instead of, you know, trying to embrace those labels, I think, you know, exploring the concept, the experience, it's not a pathological thing. The experience of self-loss might give you some peace of mind in terms of like what is happening for you and maybe what to do about it.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love what you said. That's not a pathological problem to explore self-loss. You don't have to get stuck behind a label. That's very, very powerful. Very, very powerful.
Yeah, and that's not the point. It's just an experience, right? Mm. It's just like an experience, like going to the store, a little painful, but it's not meant to. I don't also want self-loss to now be used as a label of like, this is what everyone is self-loss. And you're like, this is the new narcissism or the new trauma or the new, that's not the point. Yeah. It's just honoring each other's experiences and having a vocabulary to speak about it, I think is really liberating.
That's beautiful. I love that. So where can people get hold of the book and where can they get hold of you?
So the book is available September 19. Woohoo.
So excited and, for you.
Thank you. And you can get it anywhere books are sold. You can also get Kindle and audio where I'm reading the book and doing a hell of a better job than what I just did here.
You did a great job.
Thanks. Millennial.therapist is where I post daily content. And then if you're interested in more existential work that I do, I have a free newsletter that comes out weekly for the most part. And that's on Substack under Sarah Kubrick.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. And I look forward to our next conversation. As always, it's a pleasure.
Same. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you.